Melissa Watson.
And I'm Dr. Beth Mollison.
Thanks for joining us in the Veterinary Break Room. These are short conversations where Dr. Beth and I just chat informally about relevant topics in veterinary medicine. And today we're going to be talking about treating our personal pets. One of the reasons that this topic came up, for those of you who listen to the podcast and maybe have been following a little bit of Luna, that's my dog's journey. So I have an 8-year-old dog day Bordeaux, and she is the love of my life. She is my heart dog. About 2 months ago, she started limping, and she has elbow dysplasia, hip dysplasia. We've battled with that for a really long time. But this was a little different. I couldn't localize her pain to the normal spots. And then I noticed that she started to have a little bit of a swollen toe. And so that fifth digit, on the left front was swollen.
Poor girl.
Yeah. So we increased her pain medicine a little bit, and I decided to take her in and take a look at her. So I took her into the clinic where I still do some relief work for, and luckily, you know, that, my boss there is wonderful. And so I was able to just squeeze her right in, and took an x-ray, and luckily I did not see anything, any bony involvement or anything there. So I decided I'd go ahead and do an aspirate of it. And I was really excited because that aspirate came back, with no evidence of neoplasia. It looked like pyogranulomatous inflammation. I shared it as one of my win of the weeks. You know, Dr. Beth and I, at the end of our conversations, often share, you know, something that has gone right recently. And so I was really happy, and I put her on some cephalexin, and then waited. I thought she was getting a little bit better, but then I noticed that the nail was starting to elevate, and I could actually kind of see a fleshy mass. So ended up taking her to surgery. I removed her toe. I did it myself. I did the surgery myself. So I actually really enjoy surgery. Was not really stressed or anything about that. And much more stressed about what it was going to come back as. and it did end up coming back as a squamous cell, which was a little bit surprising to me. I wasn't really expecting that. And that was at that point, that's kind of where we left off last time, I think, with my win of the week. Mm-hmm. But she has continued to heal well. And since then, I have contacted our local oncologist. He is absolutely wonderful. And talked a little bit about what's going on with her. And good news is she's probably cured. Okay. So, but I do need
that's to, great
yeah, news. I know it is great news. I'm really happy with that. And he was so helpful. You know, I did a little bit of literature search on my own, but I was kind of, I've been a little cancered out. We've had, you know, cancer, in my, we've been dealing with my mom's ovarian cancer and some other things recently. And so I just kind of needed somebody to step in, and help me out, 'cause my brain was getting a little tired.
Absolutely understandable.
Yeah. And so, but it, like I said, it got us talking about, well, how do we handle our own pets? You know, do we do all of their care? Do we just do their preventive care? And for the majority of my pets' care, I like to handle most things myself. What about you?
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. You know, I am interested to hear, because I do feel like different people feel so differently about when we talk about that question. And I feel like I'm kind of maybe similar to you. Like, I think I also would have been comfortable doing the procedure myself. So I have Paul, again, if anybody's listened to this podcast, Paul comes up a lot, just happens to come up a lot. And my little dachshund, and I have done, you know, I do his preventive care, easy enough, not too traumatic. He's pretty well behaved in the clinic. It's not like he's better or worse for me than anybody else. So just as easy to do it myself. I have done like his routine dental cleanings and things like that. Same thing, you know, the procedural stuff doesn't necessarily bother me, but I learned last year, similar to poor Luna, he had his own little health crisis last year where he, basically, long story short, was very tachypneic. And of course, he's a dachshund. So it's like, does he have a painful back? And that's where I start to like lose my clinical judgment, I feel like, is when you're trying to do that troubleshooting, you're trying to assess them neutrally and, you know, trying to do a respiratory rate on him, trying to assess his mood. Suddenly that just becomes, I feel like you lose your neutrality, or at least I should say I did. And that was a very difficult situation for me. I didn't know, you know, do I rush him to the ER? Is he just painful? I feel like I should be able to differentiate these things. You know, as veterinarians, I do feel like at least we're lucky enough that we have, at least this is where I called, like you said, you called the oncologist, I called on my network of friends to examine him. You know, I'm fortunate to have a good friend that's a neurologist. She looked at him. My very best friend is an internist. So I basically told him, I was like, you're the one in charge. I will relay the clinical symptoms I'm seeing, but you are going to make all the judgments here. And yes, that's when I realized that, hey, maybe I'm not someone that can objectively handle all of my patients, you know, all of my pets' care myself. And I've had colleagues too that feel uncomfortable even doing the preventive care mm-hmm. stuff. So, you know, I know I've done dental procedures on some of my colleagues' pets just because the idea of their own pet being under anesthesia, especially I think, again, in those troubleshooting situations where if something does go wrong, are you going to lose all sense of ability to troubleshoot? But yeah, it's interesting. Yep. Seeing where people lie on that spectrum.
It is. And I would say, for me, it depends very much on, is it something that, you know, I like to do or I'm comfortable doing? You know, I don't like dentistry. I hate removing teeth. And actually Luna did have to, she had a slab fracture, of 108. And I totally had my colleague do that because he's great at dentistry and he could get that tooth out of there so much faster. It was better for her. And so I just moved over.
It's nice. Yes. It's so nice. It makes me wish that like, I had the equivalent in the human health field. You know, mm-hmm. once you're a member of the veterinary health field and you know, like, I don't know, it's just so much easier to navigate. I feel the same way about our own pets or our own, yeah, you know, is it something that is in my wheelhouse? I know that all vets are not created equally. You know, maybe there is a colleague that has a certain skill set that I can utilize for my own pet, whereas the general public doesn't always have that insight. So it is interesting. But Alyssa, I know it kind of sparked in us our curiosity to see how other people feel. So tell us about the survey that you conducted.
Yeah, so we decided to put out a couple surveys, one through Clinician's Brief, and then one just like an informal Facebook poll on one of our groups. And we got quite a few of the same answers. So, you know, a small majority of people handle their like only preventive care, you know, just nothing else. So, I mean, I would consider that just like vaccines, you know, heartworm prevention, stuff like that. So on the Facebook poll, that was about 6%, you know, 6% of people, okay. And about 400 people answered that poll. In fact, about 400 people answered both polls. On the other survey, the one that went out to the Clinician's Brief audience, that only handle routine care was 34%. Now, I think that was a lot higher because there were a few more specific answers on the Facebook poll. Mm-hmm. And I think it really reflected a lot like what you and I were just talking about. So one of the really common things on the Facebook poll was 37% of veterinarians said they'll treat routine and non-routine illnesses in their pets unless it requires something that they don't have access to. So like a specialist, sure. A CT makes scanner, sense. You know, something like that, where in those instances, they're gonna, you know, go seek outside care. And then a small amount of veterinarians, so 7% on the Facebook survey and 13% on the clinician's brief survey said that they always have, you know, a trusted colleague handle their pet's medical care, even routine things or preventive care. And the reasons behind that ranged a little bit. Some people weren't in clinical practice anymore. You know, some people, you know, were a specialist and they said they didn't really want to touch anything outside of their wheelhouse.
Makes sense.
So I feel like we're, you know, fairly representative of what at least these tiny little, you know, non-scientific surveys.
No, I do think it's interesting. And I do think, you know, it's on the ends of the spectrum, mm-hmm. I think is what's unique. You know, some people feel so passionately about it. And we had an interesting scenario come up where I worked for a corporate practice a few years ago. It came down the chain of command that they actually did not want us working on our own pets. Mm-hmm. And I assume that has to do with, of course, just ensuring that things are charged appropriately and protocols are followed. I imagine that they thought that would kind of, I don't know, help streamline things and help make sure nothing was missed. And that's where I suddenly found myself feeling like I was on one end of the spectrum. I just very adamantly felt like, you know, I did not dedicate my whole life to learning how to care for animals. Of course, who do we love more than anybody else is our own pets. And I did not go through all of this to then be told that I cannot treat my own pets. And that very much just was upsetting to me. I think things have since changed as far as it, that being allowed or not. But that was, you know, really bothersome to feel like I have this skill set. Who better to use it on than my own pets? But it did also get me thinking a little bit too. You know, I think when it comes to pet insurance, I have heard that there are some pet insurances that you can run into issues sure. if you were the treating doctor, mm-hmm. which then to me also makes me wonder, you know, there are some towns, cities, whatever, that you might be the only vet there. So I just found that really interesting.
Right, exactly. What do you do if you're the only one in town and you have insurance that does not allow you to be your own pet's veterinarian? So...
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. And I ran into that a little bit too, where just to kind of touch on the legality of it as well and controlled substances, I wanted to, I think I was the only, you know, the person that, again, like I said, I'm little Paul's primary care veterinarian. So of course, when he needed alprazolam for the storms, I went ahead to call it in. And of course, you know, realized that maybe I think the pharmacy gave me pushback. And Alyssa, I think you were looking into this as well. Yep. About maybe some of the laws around
that. Yeah, I absolutely did. That is one place where, again, I've always been really lucky to have wonderful, trusted colleagues. I have had animals. Luna, not at all. She doesn't have, you know, storm phobia or anything like that. But my Great Dane that has since passed on, Porter, she was petrified of fireworks. Petrified of, you know, loud noises, and she would go hide in the bathtub, which was always fun to find.
I had a Greyhound, Dane in the similar, bathtub. Yes. Yep, same with the Greyhound. It does. I will say it gave me much more empathy for the clients that come in complaining of these issues. Right. But anyway, go ahead.
And so, and that is one place where I've always had, you know, I've just asked a colleague to call in alprazolam, you know, or any other controlled substance, just so that there is no, you know, question whatsoever, you know, about that. And honestly, I don't think that there's any federal laws prohibiting us from calling in controlled substances for our own pets. The only reason mm-hmm. I do it is for appearances, and it probably sure. stems a little bit from, you know, my family, because my brother is a human physician, and they definitely cannot call in, you know, controlled substances sure. for immediate family members. And so
yeah,
I kind of
that
think
makes
of
sense.
My pet as an immediate family member.
That's I too, yeah, as you should. I have had a similar issue where fortunately I have colleagues that are happy to make the phone call for mm-hmm. me. And my pets have always too had human names, like Paul, and Eric was my storm phobic greyhound. So like, mm-hmm. even though I know I'm calling it in for my pet, I always get like a little sweaty mm-hmm. leaving the message. I'm like, they probably think this is a human. I'm trying to call in medications, you know, for humans. So my own anxiety is just easier rule following to have somebody else do it. But I did run into that issue with to end Paul's medical mystery. He wound up having, you know, PTEs in his lungs and has since had to remain on Eliquis and Plavix to maintain a normal, you know, blood clotting TEG. And one of the pharmacies gave me a hard time even just for calling those medications in. And it sounded like they had made a new rule that you couldn't call in medications even for your own pets, which, again, I found fascinating. And it made me wonder what sort of issues they had run into that made them make that rule. Yeah. But I thought that was interesting, too. Yeah. So it could be something that varies by pharmacy.
Sure. I bet it could totally vary by pharmacy. And it might be, you know, getting a little bit confused about regulations, you know, with, you know, what is okay for human physicians to do versus...
Good point. Yeah.
Although I definitely know that human physicians can call non-controlled substances in for their only family members too.
Yes. And speaking of family members, Alyssa, I know we talked about our own pets. Maybe even a hotter topic is like, how do you feel about treating... your family members' pets or your good friends' pets? Is that something you like to do?
I will say that I do mostly treat my family members' pets. So, you know, again, unless there's something that I can't handle, you know, but I've always treated my family's here in town. And so that makes a huge difference. Although I will tell you, I do get, you know, the occasional call from cousins and others. In fact, I did actually just get a call from a cousin who I absolutely adore in Wisconsin, and her dog had fallen in the pool. And so, yeah, so she FaceTimed me and I was like, you gotta go right now, because it was, you know, a little bully breed. And so she did great, and she ended up making it, but she was in the ER for a couple days on oxygen. And so, so I don't mind at all giving advice. I do definitely, it's a little stressful, you know, when I get a FaceTime call or something like that, and I'm not physically there, you know, to,
right.
Cause I'm like, there's not a lot I can do from here. You know? So, but you know, I do treat my brother's pets. My parents don't have any pets right now. But if they did, I'm sure I would treat them.
Fair enough. Yeah, actually, now that I say that, I realize that none of my family members have pets. I'm not sure what that says about my family. I'm shocked by this. Yeah, my sister-in-law, my parents don't have any pets. Anyway, so yes, but when it comes to like friends, I think I'm with you. I like being able to provide that help and support. I know that they trust me. But for me, it always becomes a little bit of a conundrum. Like, you know, say a friend brings their pet in that's vomiting. I always have that little bit of like, oh, we could probably just try, whatever the case may be, try Serenia for the day or whatever. And I really have that fine line of being like, here's the conservative stuff I would do for my own pet because I know how to monitor and I know what the risks and benefits are, versus like, no, here's the plan I should be recommending because this is what I would recommend for anybody else that came in. So sometimes I do find myself kind of in that gray zone of trying to figure out what my recommendations are. And then I would say the other challenge is similar to yours. Like you mentioned, it's not that I don't want to help you via Facebook Messenger. It's like, you know, do I have the information that I need? No. And therefore, you know, we're both doing each other a disservice by not actually being able to provide, you know, as much help as I would like. Yeah. And then of course there's always the euthanasia issue. Or I should say subject, not issue. But obviously, Alyssa, this is your wheelhouse. You do a lot of in-home euthanasias. Is that something,
that's,
service you extend to friends and family? Yep,
it is. Absolutely. In fact, I just very recently put down my brother-in-law's dog in their home. And my niece and nephew were there on FaceTime because they're away at college now. And so it was a beautiful, beautiful experience. For my own pets, that is one place where I do step back and let a colleague, because I would much rather, you know, be present and not be the doctor there. So how about you? I know it's a sad thing to talk about, but have you had to have your personal pets?
You know, I One of my greyhounds, he died suddenly, so euthanasia was not, I'm just trying to think through this. Euthanasia was not in the cards for him. My other greyhound, she took a downward turn in the middle of the night, so she was euthanized at an emergency facility. My family dog growing up, she was euthanized, and I had a colleague do it. And I, this is speaking of like the most controversial things you could possibly say. I feel like in the veterinary profession, we feel for some reason very strongly about the idea that owners should be with their pets when they're euthanized. I think maybe I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but a colleague did it. I was not with our old beagle when she was euthanized. She, I think, had some cognitive dysfunction as she got older and was so anxious at the vet, not anxious to the point where it's going to help that I'm there, but the opposite. You know, it's really a hindrance for me to be there, to be around, because you have her anxiety level and just not even anxiety. You know, we tried to medicate her, but it was just that confusion at the end. So I had a trusted colleague who handled that because I knew there was a high chance there would be a little bit of, you know, just images that I didn't necessarily want to remember. And so again, that is when it's nice to be in the veterinary profession and feel like you really have a colleague you can trust that will treat them like your own. And let's see, friend wise, I euthanized a friend's pet. That was also a really lovely experience to feel like, you know, we could be outside of the blinding lights of the public eye in our own clinic, but be able to, you know, go somewhere else and have it done. So yeah, sad topics, but it does, talking about it makes me realize how lucky we are to have those options being members of the profession.
Yeah, we really are lucky. Okay. So speaking of being thankful, this is kind of normally wrapping up the episode when we would do our win of the week, Dr. Beth, but I was thinking since it's Thanksgiving time, we might instead share something that we're thankful for.
Oh, I like that. Where to begin? You know, I'm going to go big picture here, and given what the last 2 years have looked like, you know, I'm thankful that it's not 2020 or 2021. And I mean that based around COVID, if you haven't caught on. But yeah, just the fact that this year has been quote unquote normalish to some degree. I think I never want to lose sight of how nice it is to not be living in the heat of a pandemic. So that's what I'm going to be thankful for right now. Even though I know we're, you know, marching down the path of cold and flu season, I will still be thankful that it's not winter of 2020. What about you, Alyssa?
That's a very good one. I'm going to go big picture too. We definitely have had, again, because things are getting back to normal, we've had some big family trips, you know, this year that have been really wonderful. We were able to take a Disney cruise up to Alaska, and then also a little Disney cruise around Halloween time, and that one with my parents, my mom. So my mom's been going through some significant medical treatments, including two big surgeries at Mayo, and rounds and rounds of chemo. And, you know, at this point, everything looks, you know, like they've gotten all the cancer at her surgery, and her levels have all stayed normal, and we're just very thankful for everything going on.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, so thankful.
Good. Well, that's a good one to end on, Alyssa. I'm so glad to hear she's doing well. So yes, thank you everyone for joining us. Hope everyone's family and little pets stay nice and healthy so no one's treating their own pets this holiday season. And we will see you all soon.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of Veterinary Break Room. If you enjoyed today's episode, you can find us wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. While you're there, make sure you subscribe, rate, and review. You can also listen to podcasts on our website at cliniciansbrief.com/podcasts or drop us a line at podcasts@briefmedia.com. Veterinary Break Room is a Brief Media production produced by Alexis Ussery, with sound by Randall Stupka, and co-hosted by Dr. Alyssa Watson and Dr. Beth Mollison.